We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour focus, we'll be talking about a recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, it was announced just last week. The court issued a ruling that many people believe will end up limiting the use of class actions in employment discrimination. In fact, there are people who think that will eliminate the use of class actions in number of different situations. This was a case that was brought by women who worked for Walmart, who argued that they had been denied opportunities for advancement in the company because of their gender. The court found in favor of Walmart in this case. Supporters of those who brought the suit argue that the high court's action will make it much more difficult to pursue charges of sex discrimination against large corporations. We'll try to talk about the case and the implications of the case this morning in this part of the show. And we have two guests. They're both joining us by telephone. Leslie Wexler, she is an associate professor of law in the College of Law at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. And also Michael Leroy. He's professor of labor and industrial relations and law in the School of Labor and Employment Relations and also in the College of Law here at the University of Illinois. So as we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. We hope, again, people can be brief and on target with the topic, but questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We do have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that. We'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. We do also have email. You can send a question that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Wexler, hello.
Hi.
And Professor Leroy, hello.
Hi.
Hey, thanks very much to both of you for talking with us. And as we talk, at some point, if one of you is talking and the other would like to add on to the point or take it in a slightly different direction, feel free to do that. It's a little more difficult here when none of us can see each other, but don't hesitate if there's a lull and you'd like to make a point, so do go ahead. Well, I think one of the things that we should do here at the beginning is just talk a little bit about the case of Dukes v. Walmart, which has been in making its way through the courts actually for some time. That's one of those illustrations about the wheels of justice grinding slowly. This case began in 2000 in California with this woman, Betty Dukes, who filed a sex discrimination suit against the company, Walmart. And maybe, I don't know, Professor Wexler, can you just talk a little bit about the background of the case?
Sure. So Betty Dukes, I think, as lead plaintiff, is fairly representative of the kind of women that are joined in the class. She started off at a very low level. She was a cashier at a Walmart. She was eventually promoted to manager. But as she complained about what she saw as being sex-related disparities, she was demoted down first to cashier and eventually to a greeter, where she claims that she was being paid less than male greeters in nearby stores. There are other lead plaintiffs like Christine Kapnowski, who is a manager. There's a woman, Edith Arana, who claims that she was repeatedly denied management training when she sought it out. And, you know, these are just three examples of the millions of women who have joined together to complain about what they see as Walmart's unfair behavior.
Mm-hmm. And it does. It certainly. It seems to be the case that one can perhaps argue about why it's the case, but it does seem to be the case. If you look at the makeup of the employees of the company, you take a look at who did what jobs. You take a look at how many people there were in the sales force and how many people there were in management, that something does seem to be going on here, because most of the management was male. On average, women earned less. Even the male cashiers, even though there were fewer of them, made more than the female cashiers. So it would seem that there would be at the basis for an argument that something was going on here.
I think that's right. Now, what Walmart would tell you is that the reason there are less women in management is because women were less interested in management. So their contention is, you know, it may just be that either women weren't applying for these jobs or they weren't willing to do things like relocate their families. They'd also make the claim that while it may be, if you sort of look at the statistics of all 3,400 stores as a whole, it looks bad, but if you went store by store, maybe it would look different, which is why Walmart was so interested in getting the class decertified. The numbers look really bad for them if you look at all of them together, which is why they want each plaintiff to fight it out on a case-by-case basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly would, for the company, it certainly would have been difficult, because even if the, say, if some damages were awarded in the form of back wages, some women argued that they were entitled to wages that they would have received had they been able to have the kind of advancement they wanted. Even if some percentage of the women who were involved in this class were successful in arguing for some damages, if you're talking about 1.5 million people in the class, you're talking about some serious money. So in that case, you could understand why the court would want to limit the size of the where the company would want to limit the size of the class.
That's certainly right. Yeah. It's definitely in their interest from a financial perspective, particularly for another reason, which is that class actions allow all of the women to use a common set of lawyers to consolidate their resources. But if each woman who is working at Walmart getting paid $7 or $8 an hour as a greeter has to hire her own lawyer, that's another way that Walmart can get rid of a lot of these claims, because many of these women simply couldn't afford to go it alone.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I don't know anything that you might, Professor Leroy, might want to add here, particularly in just in how you consider this case within the similar kinds of cases that have happened in the past.
Sure. I don't challenge anything that Leslie is representing, but I think the picture is more complex than we've discussed so far.
Mm-hmm.
Labor economists still consistently report findings that in the American economy, women, when you adjust for qualifications and the type of work performed for a particular job, make 80 cents for every dollar earned by a man. And I think it's important to sort of consider or frame Walmart's employment practices in the broader context of what's happening in the United States. And the question is, why do women make 80% of what a man makes? And then the question for a court is to disentangle the complex, broad, and still poorly understood effects of sex discrimination with respect to pay versus the specific employment practices of Walmart that contribute to a pay disparity, a promotion disparity, or similar. So, you know, that part is just, I think it's close to impossible for a court to pull apart when you're looking at 1.5 million individuals.
Mm-hmm. Anything, Professor Wexler, anything that you'd want to add to that?
Well, I do think that the court is very worried about its institutional capacity, its ability to resolve these claims. On the other hand, part of what the real fight here is about whether or not, you know, these structural complaints about the nature of the workplace can be adjudicated. And the plaintiffs think that they can, because they think there are sort of a common set of reasons that run across the stores that, while the details may vary, the sort of fundamental nature of what's gone wrong, they say, is similar across the cases.
Yeah, that's interesting. And just to make the conversation interesting, I would point out that the Supreme Court's decision notes that throughout this 10-year litigation trail, there are approximately 120 anecdotal accounts from various members of the class relating to employment discrimination. And when you read the majority opinion in this case, the point that Justice Scalia makes is, how can you generalize from extrapolate from 120 stories? And let's assume for the moment, as we should, that those stories are accurate and true and put a Walmart in a damaging light. How do you extrapolate from 120 anecdotal accounts to 1.5 million individuals? And that speaks to Professor Wexler's notion of institutional capacity to handle this just enormous volume of claims. Mm.
Well, just to, and I know there's some technical in the decision of the court, there's some technical stuff here that I'm not sure that I completely understand. But what I guess what I come away from it is the idea that the court, and in some way the entire court, but different sections of it for different reasons, what they're saying about this, they were making a ruling on technical grounds. They weren't really ruling on whether or not there actually was sex discrimination here. But what seemed to be that they're saying was that this class, 1.5 million people, there's just no way that can work, that it's just too big, and that there's no way that all of these 1.5 million women could really they seem to be saying, well, their experiences are going to be different because there's just too many people here. So the door is still open for class actions, for individuals to sue and for people to sue in groups. But it seemed that what the court was saying was that just saying, no, 1.5 million is just, as a class, that's just too big. And maybe, again, Professor Wexler, you could help. Essentially the most basic thing the court was saying was that the
sure.
class was just too big?
The court is not... That's correct. The court is not saying there couldn't be either individual claims or something like store-level claims where everyone who's working in an individual store might complain about a particular manager or a particular policy. But what I think is interesting is while the court isn't really speaking to the merits, this is a procedural issue about whether the class was properly certified, you will read in Scalia's opinion a real skepticism about the evidence that does go to the substance. It's his contention that, you know, it would be extraordinary, it would be very unusual to assume that employers in a company would discriminate. He says we should presume that if left to their own devices, they would select sex-neutral policies, performance-based criteria, and so in some ways, even though it is a decision about procedure, about class certification, the majority is saying something about what they think about sort of the background world of discrimination and whether that's a normal or an extraordinary occurrence. Mm.
Well, it is worth noting, as many people have in writing about the case, that all three of the women on the court were in the dissent. And so some people have argued that, well, the guys on the court don't quite get this, but the women do.
David, I don't want to sound like one of the guys who doesn't get it, because my research looks at arbitration of employment discrimination claims, and I have identified evidence of discrimination against women when they pursue claims like Betty Dukes did, in the context of arbitration, which is a private dispute resolution process. But I have found in one study that women get smaller remedies than men, and there's no apparent explanation except for the fact that they are women. Mm-hmm. But with all that said, I think it's important for listeners who haven't read the decision or know about the decision to understand that most of the evidence that is being put forward before the Supreme Court and lower courts is statistical evidence. And so I would have us reflect just on our own community. If we were to rank our top earners at the University of Illinois, I would submit that most of them are men, and that if you just go by statistics, you might find a somewhat similar pattern of occupational segregation and managerial segregation that also translates into differential pay levels, with clear gender effects. And the question is the University of Illinois discriminatory when you look at that kind of statistical evidence? I mean, Bruce Weber makes a lot more money as a basketball coach than Gillette Law. Well, on the face of it, that's discriminatory. So, I mean, it's important to, and I'm not deciding whether it is or isn't discriminatory. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to illustrate here is that the evidence is largely statistical. It is not a person coming forward and saying, you know, this is my story, this is what happened to me, he got that, and I got this. It is taking a mass of data, separating it, and saying, well, golly, the men, we have more men here than elsewhere, and why is that?
Yeah. Well, I'll turn it back to Professor Wexler. I guess it sounds as if from Professor LeRoy, essentially what he's saying is that the cases, this kind of case really needs to be decided on a case-by-case basis. What do you think of the idea that you could have a class action lawsuit with a class of 1.5 million women in it, or 1.5 million, maybe wouldn't just say, don't say women, 1.5 million people in it?
Sure. So I think, you know, he raises a nice point that most of the evidence is statistical. We've already talked about the anecdotal evidence, which is present, and perhaps the plaintiff should have submitted more anecdotes, so across all of the states, different types of positions. There's also a third type of evidence that was presented that the court was very skeptical about, which is called social framework analysis. And this was done by a sociologist, William, I believe his last name is pronounced Bielby. And that evidence that he offered was to make sense of the statistics, to understand sort of how, once you look at the numbers, what the background sort of operating forces are that might explain it. And the court really didn't like that evidence. The court was very skeptical that this is the sort of thing that should be admitted, though they didn't say it was inadmissible, but they were very skeptical about the evidence in general or their ability to sort of wade through it. And I think that if courts are going to be skeptical about all of these types of evidence, as the Supreme Court was, then that's right. It makes class actions very difficult to adjudicate. I don't think the court had to rule the way that it did, but if you take the court seriously that statistical evidence alone isn't enough, but anecdotal evidence has to be sort of representative of the class in a large number, it does make it difficult for a large class to succeed. Does it make it difficult for all large classes to succeed? I don't think so. There will still be lots of class action lawsuits where all of the plaintiffs are very similarly situated. So imagine a class action where you have some sort of consumer action where they all had the same rider in a contract, or they were all told the same thing about a product that they purchased. Those claims, I think, will still be quite easy to adjudicate as a class.
Mm-hmm. Well, here again, I'll come back to Professor LeRoy. I wonder whether you think. I think that some people, in looking at the outcome of the case, have raised questions, raised really big questions, very big questions about the future of class action lawsuits, and whether, in fact, the result of this case is that it will be more difficult for some large group of individuals. Whether we're talking about employees who are interested in pursuing action against an employer. We could be talking about consumers. It could be a different kind of situation. But do you think that, in fact, that it will make it more difficult to be successful in a very large class action suit?
Sure. It is going to be much more difficult. At the top of the program, you mentioned that this has potential to eliminate class actions. That's probably overstating it. It's going to narrow certification of classes.
Mm-hmm.
For perspective, I mean, we might think of, our listeners and us might think of personal accounts where we are shareholders or we are consumers, to name two common class action scenarios, where we get a notice from a court, and it tells us you have a $30 coupon to go to such and such store because of a consumer class action claim or similar. And the point I'm driving at is many of these mega class actions are successful in the aggregate, but to individuals, they offer a pittance.
Mm-hmm.
And so as courts aggregate more and more claims, they can't isolate or even approximate individual damages. So what they wind up doing is you have a headline, big corporation settles class action lawsuit for $500 million. Well, that's impressive. When you then figure out the distribution of money to claimants, it's a much different story. And then when you figure out the lawyer's take of it in the class action, which can be typically up to a third of the settlement, that puts it in a somewhat different light.
Mm. That's a point I want to come back to, and perhaps I'll have ask Professor Wexler to talk about that, or at least give me a response. But I have a caller here, and rather than make them wait, I'd just like to get them in, someone who's listening in Urbana. So let's do that on our line number one. Hello.
I would definitely agree with your comment that the lawyers take way too big a chunk of any settlement that occurs. But barring the fact you don't have those settlements, there's nothing to prevent the power brokers, the big corporations, the big organizations, anybody else from just blatantly discriminating at people or consumers or anybody without any kind of penalty. We can't put them in jail. They're given full legal rights when it comes to being able to donate to politicians, but you can't put a corporation in jail for violating individuals' rights. You have to have some kind of remedy. And quite frankly, it's just my opinion. I'll be interested to see what your opinion is. I don't think anybody but a couple of lawyers with shingles in front of them representing Walmart could have lost this case. And this case was predetermined before the justices even heard the evidence. The five people who voted, at least four of the five people who voted in favor of Walmart, were going to vote in favor of Walmart no matter what the evidence showed. And the fifth, more than likely, was going to do the same thing. This court's so loaded. This court's dangerous. It's scary because we really need an effective Supreme Court. It's the only balance against craziness in politics. Yet this court is so political and so unbalanced that you can almost predetermine every case that comes before him just under political attitudes. Thank you.
Well, all right. Yeah, go ahead, Professor Wexler. What do you think?
So I think that I agree with a large part of the sentiment, which is without damages, it is very difficult without class actions to get these employers to change their employment behavior. And what I think is worth noting is that while the individual remedies in these cases would have been quite small, although the back pay for some individuals might have been significant, for most it was going to be a relatively small amount. Part of what they were asking for was declaratory and injunctive relief. They wanted Walmart to change its behaviors, and had Walmart not won at this stage, I think it's very likely that they would have settled the lawsuit. And like Coca-Cola and some other employers that have been subject to large class action lawsuits in the discrimination realm, they would have massively overhauled their employment practices, and that's something that it's difficult to imagine them doing without a class action lawsuit. Now, do I think the answer was predetermined? I do think you often see, sort of a similar lineup of judges in cases, but I don't think it's because they're overwhelmingly pro-corporation. I do think sometimes it's because there are some people that are just more worried than others on the court about institutional capacity. Whose job do they think it is to resolve these sorts of things? And some of them just don't think that courts are good at these sorts of class actions. On the other hand, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Leslie.
Well, I was also just going to say it is consistent with what you see them doing in other areas. So they've really been narrowing and heightening the pleading requirements, which are another way that they can make it more difficult for plaintiffs to get to court on employment discrimination action. So you could say this is a court that is hostile, and they're using procedure in a lot of different ways to narrow the avenues to the courts on these sorts of issues.
Speaking to the caller's point, I agree wholeheartedly that large class actions have, even if individuals don't win, so to speak, or win much, they can hold large corporations accountable and they can effect change that is good for society. I think that's a very important point. With that said, In my perfect world, I would have preferred the plaintiff attorneys to find out of the vast pool of 1.5 million members of the class, don't you think they could find 1,000 compelling stories of sex discrimination? Look, off the cuff, I think that's possible. You got to dig, you got to investigate, you got to find. Then you pull your 1,000 really compelling stories together. And then you sue for sex discrimination and related state law claims and punitive damages, and then you can affect the same change or perhaps greater change. So that's one notion. Speaking to Professor Wexler's interesting point about the court narrowing access to courts, I agree. And there's another decision by the Supreme Court in this term that almost is parallel to the Walmart case. It would limit our ability as consumers, employees, tenants, whatever, to file class action arbitration claims. So more and more large entities, corporations, employers, and so banks, telecom, so forth, when we sign agreements, when we enter into arrangements with them, they require us to arbitrate our claims. And now we're learning from the Supreme Court that we really are going to have difficulty acting as a class. We're going to have to arbitrate our individual claims. And that speaks to Professor Wexler's really good point about the inability of low-wage earners or people without means to carry on a contest with AT&T or Walmart or similar. So not only is the Supreme Court narrowing access to public courts, it's also narrowing access to what are called private courts.
Well, just I guess the general point here, when you have to say that the benefit or the potential of a class action suit is that you can have individuals that, as individuals, wouldn't have the means to pursue a legal action, can band together and then make it possible to do that. On the other hand, that if what you're primarily interested in is some kind of award of damages for the individuals, when you have such a large class, maybe it doesn't even have to be that large, then what each individual gets is relatively small. Is that just the trade-off that you have to make? Is that just something that's in the nature of a class action suit?
I think so. And just to add another point to it, in my opinion, had this had the ruling come out differently, and had the matter been scheduled for trial in some fashion, I think eventually the case would have settled, and I think the case would have settled for what would make a headline story—a large sum of money. But very few of these actually get to trial, and there are a lot of stories behind that. It took 11 years to litigate what's an appropriate class. But the point I'm driving at is the larger and larger the class, it seems it's more and more likely to settle. And when it settles, pardon me, you don't have Betty Dukes getting to tell her story to a judge. And you don't get a public account of it, to go to the caller's point about holding corporations accountable. You don't get any of that. And then you get settlements which are so distant in time from the occurrence and so scattershot in the big picture that you wonder whose interests are being served. Is it the large army of attorneys who are representing the class? To some extent, that's true, and that is one concern I have.
So I'd actually like to speak to that question. So Cohen Milstein, which is the law firm that represented the plaintiffs in this class, is actually sunk $7 million of its own dollars into this lawsuit. So they spent about $5 million in attorney hours and $2 million on doing experts and discovery. And I think that it's hard to imagine a law firm being able to do that without, some contingency fee being available. And while it's distasteful at some level to say, a large chunk of the outcome is going to go to the lawyers and not to the individuals, the lawyers also couldn't do this kind of work without, a fairly hefty contingency fee. Now, I'm sure that they will, take some profit as well, but these lawsuits are incredibly expensive to do and to do well. So as Professor Leroy pointed out, why didn't they have 1,000 anecdotes? Why did they only have 100? Who knows how many more attorney hours that it would have taken to produce 1,000 anecdotes rather than 100. These lawsuits are just incredibly expensive, which is in some ways just the nature of the American judicial system, that it requires so many man hours and so much expertise, litigation is just incredibly expensive.
Hmm. We need to take just a very short break here. I have another caller we'll get right to. We're talking in this hour about the Dukes v. Walmart case just handed down by the Supreme Court last week and its implications for class action suits. And we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret history of Iraq's invisible war, the war fought in radio frequencies to explode IEDs and to jam those detonators. We talk with Noah Shachtman, who writes the national security blog Danger Room for Wired magazine. We'll also talk about new high-tech weapons in the works. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. We're here weekday mornings, and we have 10 different topics every week. Let me just tell you quickly about tomorrow. In the first hour, the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about workers' compensation issues in Illinois and some recent changes in the law on workers' comp. Our guest will be Robert Bruno, who teaches in the School of Labor and Employment Relations, and also David Manchetti. He's an attorney who works in this area. And then also, we'll try to, in a more general way, take a look at some of the big issues in the last session of the Illinois legislature, and they did an awful lot, more than usual. And we'll have two guests in the second hour tomorrow to talk about that. Ray Long, who is a State House reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and also Robert Rich, who is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the U of I. Celeste Quinn will host that show. As I say, we've got 10 topics for you every week. You can find out what we're doing by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You can also listen to past programs that you might have missed. In this hour of Focus, we're talking about a recent decision of the Supreme Court. This is in the Dukes v. Walmart case that has to do with an attempt to have a large class action lawsuit involving something like 1.5 million workers, women workers of Walmart, suing the company for sex discrimination. And the high court found for Walmart, and a lot of people raise questions about what this means for the future of class action lawsuits, not just in sex discrimination, but certainly in that area. And we have our two guests with us. They're both joining us by phone. Leslie Wexler is Associate Professor of Law in the College of Law at the U of I, and Michael Leroy is Professor of Labor and Industrial Relations and Law. So he's both in Labor and Industrial Relations and in the College of Law. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And here's a caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. It seems to me that there's something of a prejudice against statistical evidence here, and more pervasively with the Supreme Court in general in past instances. And maybe I've just spent too many hours in statistics courses here at the university, but I find statistics often more compelling than anecdotal evidence. The other point would be, and I'd like your comment on this as well, one of the speakers seemed to find it almost incredulous that a corporation's management would be pervasively let's say bigoted. Yet the history of these relationships is that corporations, companies, and other entities have often acted against their own interests, whether the discrimination was against females or people of color. Would you please comment?
Well, the caller raises a number of points. I think I've read something that you wrote, Professor Wexler, where you really argued that if, in fact, the company, this company or other companies, are truly engaged in this kind of discrimination, that in fact it's really not good for business, and it's quite short-sighted of them to do it.
I think that's right, that corporations can be pervasively bigoted, can make decisions that are not in their own best interest. But I think what the court is skeptical about is the prevalence of that sort of behavior. So when the court sees this sort of statistical evidence, a lot of people would look at it and say there must be discrimination afoot, the management going on, there must be something wrong. But the court says, look, there are an infinite number of explanations for this evidence. And these numbers by themselves only tell us that there aren't a lot of women managers, that women in certain positions are getting paid less. But what they want to take from that evidence, I think they are very skeptical. And in other types of employment discrimination cases, so this Walmart's case was a pattern and practice case, but even in some other cases, it being the court, really wants a lot of anecdotal evidence. It really prefers these individualized determinations to just looking at the numbers, because they feel like there are so many possible explanations for the numbers.
Yeah, my response to the caller is I do think statistics can be very meaningful. There was another case decided not long ago by the Supreme Court, which to my thinking demonstrates a much more straightforward role of the use of statistics. And it involved a female manager at Goodyear Tire. Her name is Lillian Ledbetter. But she had a lawsuit that claimed pay discrimination, and she was able to cite evidence that her pay was less than every other male manager in her region or district. I forget the geographic grouping. But she assembled powerful, persuasive evidence that she was not only underpaid relative to everybody else, but vastly underpaid. And at the end of the day, considering that the pay disparity lasted over 20 years, the question is, did Goodyear keep her on the payroll as a poor-performing employee for 20 years, or is the pay disparity a reflection of some kind of discrimination, even if you can't point to a specific instance where somebody said, gee, because you're female, we're going to pay you less? To me, that's a very persuasive use of statistics. The problem I have in thinking about the statistical evidence, and I think the majority had, thinking about the statistical evidence in the Walmart case, is how do you then isolate or attribute causation where you see a pay disparity, let's say, at the entry-level managerial position, and you are going to observe a difference between male and female pay. The question becomes, how do you attribute causation to that? What's the practice that, if you want Walmart to learn something, and many of us do, and I sure do, the simple answer is make sure you pay everybody the same. I understand that that's the intuitive answer, but the evidence is over the entire United States, and you're looking at a wide range of possible causes. And so at that point, given the magnitude, 1.5 million claimants, that's a very different sort of statistical proof than Lillian Ledbetter had against Goodyear.
Hmm. Well, this I guess it gets this difficult business of how you make your arguments, and it seems that for example, in the majority, some people in the majority on the court said there was no basis for this class action suit because there was no specific written policy in Walmart. You know, they didn't have it written down on a piece of paper that says we're going to discriminate against women. In fact, I think it's the case that the lawyer arguing for Walmart said, not only is there no policy of discriminating against women, we actually have a policy that says we're not going to discriminate. So you have that on the one hand, but then if you have this evidence on the other hand, if you take a look at women and the jobs that they do and how much they earn, it sure looks like it's discrimination. I mean, then you have to say, well, okay, how do we explain that? I guess then, and maybe I direct this question to Professor Wexler, how is it you then make your argument that it actually is discrimination and that it's somehow deliberate and it's part of corporate culture?
Sure. So I think that what you see in the majority is this focus on formal discrimination. Did they explicitly write it down? Do we think there is a particular corporate policy that we can point to that is itself sexist? And what the dissent did see, and what the plaintiff's lawyers were arguing, was that the combination of giving managers a lot of discretion and the knowledge that these disparities were occurring, those things combined together with a very strong corporate culture that, you know, emphasizes certain aspects, de-emphasizes others. Walmart knew that these statistics existed. They did their own internal studies. There were many, you might call them internal whistleblowers, who were bringing this to the top of management's attention and saying, we have a real problem here. And Walmart continued its policy of allowing a lot of discretion on the parts of individual decision makers when it could have instead said, you know, if you get so many favorable reviews, you get an automatic pay raise, or we need to make sure that our complaint procedures are set up better. I think the big disagreement between the majority and the dissent here about the discrimination part of this case is whether basically lots of delegation with a strong corporate culture, should that be seen as the equivalent of a formal policy? And the dissent said yes, and the majority said no.
Mm-hmm. I have another caller here. Let's bring them in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I've followed your conversation to some extent, and I hope I'm not asking a question that has already been covered. But given this decision with this Walmart decision, with this class action, with the women's pay, also given the rulings that have come down where corporations are given unlimited power to put all the money they want to into conducting political activities, and some of the other decisions that the Supreme Court have made, are we really moving in a direction where corporations have so much more say in American politics and American life than really what they should have?
I think that's a wonderful observation. I mean, your reference to the political speech case recently decided by the court is it's a powerful idea there that you're putting forward. It does speak to several concerns that have been voiced on the show, but you add a new element that the court is overly accommodating to large corporate interests.
Thank you very much.
All right. I don't know. Professor Wexler, anything you would want to add to that?
I agree. I think they are fairly accommodating. I am hopeful that there are some other checks that, if corporations act too egregiously, that the public is willing to step in, as we saw, you know, when Target made donations to an anti-gay candidate, you saw a limited boycott. I do think these companies are worried about their public reputations, and sometimes that's going to be a check rather than judicial behavior. And it's not a great check, but it is better than nothing.
Yeah. We talked earlier about this argument about how big is too big for a class in a class action suit, and that the one that we're talking about here would have had the potential to be, well, it would have been the biggest one in American history. We're talking about the potential of more than a million people being part of the class. Maybe one of the questions that I had was, well, who decides, and maybe more important than who decides, how do they decide whether in fact a class is too big, and who may join and who may not, and is that something some judge somewhere does, and is that, are there real rules for that, or is that something that an individual judge has to make a decision on?
It's both. There are rules that speak to what is called commonality of interest, but that requires discretion on the part of a judge to figure out what that means. So one way of looking at the majority opinion is that gender is the common denominator in the plaintiff class, but there are too many other variables in there that create a fuzzy image about the commonality of the class. I mean, you've got regional differences, you've got occupational differences, you have management versus wage earners. You have different ways of cutting up the class. So I think it'll take a long time, I don't want to even guess, but many years before you get some sort of picture of an image in the employment discrimination realm of how judges interpret and apply this standard of commonality of interest. Clearly it's going to be smaller. The question is, you know, at what level?
So maybe also, Professor Wexler, maybe it makes a difference here depending on what the issue is at hand. I suppose if it was a class action lawsuit by, say it was a consumer lawsuit against the manufacturer, then I suppose you could say, well, the class is anybody who bought the particular product or anybody who felt that they were, if we're talking about tort, I guess, everybody who thought that they were injured by a product or by the action of a company. That seems that that's pretty clear who is or is not in the class. Is it in the case that in some cases it's easier to determine what the common interest is and who's eligible to join the class, and in other cases it's just more difficult?
I think that is right. So if you think about the various types of class action lawsuits, I think they're in things like antitrust or securities regulation. I think those classes won't be, now I could be wrong, but I think they won't be too affected by this decision. But I do think employment discrimination will be affected, maybe RICO as well. I think, you know, each substantive area is going to see lower courts grappling with this decision and deciding whether or not it's sort of relevant to that, to the individualized determinations in those cases.
So you were talking a little bit earlier about the tremendous number of hours and the amount of money that the attorneys who representing the plaintiffs have already invested in this. It would seem to me, given that, and also given the potential for being successful, but either representing individuals or perhaps a smaller group, that that for the attorneys that there's no going back, that they have to, rather than declare it a loss, that don't they have to continue to pursue this to see if they can eventually prevail and justify what they've spent already?
So I actually don't think they have to. I think they've been financing this litigation with their other litigation. They do a lot of class action lawsuits. But I do think that they are likely to continue on because I think that there is still some hope for a smaller class, so maybe by region, I think would be their first choice, and I think that the litigation itself, win or lose, produces some effect on Walmart's behavior. And now, whether they're going to continue to see that, but Walmart started to reform its employment practices once the lawsuit was filed. And so if they continue on with the litigation, it may be that Walmart will continue to invest in ways to change its behavior, though certainly the biggest threat, that of the large class action, I think, is now gone. All of that being said, my prediction is they will continue the lawsuit on smaller levels, and they still have the option of doing it as a different type of class action, so they could do it as I believe it's a 23B3, not a 23B2, for those of you who aren't civil procedure junkies. It just means that it's a different type of class action. It's voluntary rather than mandatory. The class members can opt out and decide to go it alone. The standards for determining whether it should be certified are different. But it's at least that is still a possibility that's on the table.
Mm-hmm.
David, to thread back to the first part,
uh-huh,
of your comment and question there, you know, it is interesting if readers want to go online and see the expert witness report from the key expert witness in this case. As we've indicated, his name is William Bielby, B-I-E-L-B-Y. And if you just type in William Bielby expert witness, you'll see his expert witness report. And early in the report, as is common in expert witness reports, he's providing his credentials and also his rate of pay. It's interesting to note that part of his funding for his expert analysis doesn't come from a law firm, but it comes from a group called the Impact Fund. I don't know anything about the fund, but I'm just suggesting that there's a richer, more complex story to the financing of these large plaintiff class actions than we might think. And I'm not surprised, but I was a bit struck that Professor Bielby's testimony and expert analysis was coming at a $550 per hour rate. You know, where do you get the financing for this? And I think Professor Wexler spoke eloquently and convincingly to the idea that people without means really deserve access to court, and class action is the vehicle to get it done. What muddies the picture is when you get into it, you find that there are a lot of people on the plaintiff side who they're not doing it out of a sense of social justice. They're not just being well paid; they're being extravagantly paid for it, and it just creates a somewhat different image than we think, sort of in the absence of this information.
I don't know. You have a final thought there you might like to offer, Professor Wexler?
Well, this is one of those sort of uncomfortable anecdotal evidence, but I actually have met Professor Bielby, and I actually know some of the Cohen-Milstein lawyers. And, you know, if you met them, I don't think you would say these are people that are in it for the money. I think that these are people that are deeply committed to what they see as social justice and in the public interest. But I do think they're asking to be compensated at rates that are commensurate with what other lawyers or other experts are being paid to do.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that with our thanks to our guests. Leslie Wexler, she's an associate professor of law in the College of Law at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. Professor Wexler, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And Michael Leroy, he's professor of labor and industrial relations and law, both in School of Labor and Employment Relations and the College of Law here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And Professor Leroy, thank you very much.
Thank you both.